The IER podcast is produced by Creative Kin and sponsored by Thompson Solicitors. Thanks for listening.
This is the first realistic chance we've had to revise the industrial relations structure of this country since Mrs. Thatcher came to power in 1979. It is a pivotal moment.
Trade unions today have forgotten about their role as regulators on behalf of workers in determining terms and conditions of employment. What we have instead is this enterprise-based system where unions are simply representing defined groups of workers in their direct relationships with their employers. And well, that's fine, but it can't be the fulfillment of trade union ambition.
Hi, I'm James Harrison, Director of the Institute of Employment Rights. Welcome to the fourth episode of our new podcast. Thanks to Thompson Solicitors for sponsoring the podcast. Please visit thompsons.law/employment-bill to learn more from their team of employment law experts on the government's employment rights bill. In this fourth episode, our labour law experts, Professor Keith Ewing and Lord John Hendy KC, our president and chairperson, will discuss their analysis of the Labour Party's employment rights bill, this time taking a look at the impact the bill will have on collective rights, union organising, trade union bargaining, the right to strike, and the UK's compliance with international law. Initially, we intended for this to be just one episode, but we realised we had so much good stuff that we've decided to split this episode into two parts. So we hope that you enjoy both parts of this stimulating discussion. So, John and Keith, we've touched on this a little bit in previous episodes of the podcast, but I know there's still other aspects for us to talk about on collective bargaining. The vast majority of workers have no say over the terms and conditions on which they work. You've both been strong advocates for the extension of collective bargaining across all sectors of the economy, so as to give workers through their unions a voice in setting terms and conditions and resolving disputes. So firstly, John, what are the benefits of sector-wide collective bargaining?
Well, there's been a lot of research about collective bargaining and sectoral collective bargaining in particular. And what that research demonstrates is that an economy with extensive collective bargaining is more productive, more efficient, has less inequality, and has higher wages than economies that don't have extensive collective bargaining. And the reality is that you can't have extensive collective bargaining simply on an enterprise basis. That's to say, where unions and employers negotiate for the particular workplace or the particular firm. What you need is collective bargaining stretching across an entire sector of the economy. And you've got to remember that that was the case in the United Kingdom from the early years of the 20th century right through until the 1990s. I mean, in 1976, we had 86% of British workers were covered by a collective agreement to some extent, which means that more than 8 out of 10 workers had a say through their unions in setting terms and conditions. Now, that percentage now has dropped very considerably. There's some controversy about the current level of collective bargaining, but my own estimate is that it's certainly no more than 25% of workers are negotiated for by unions. And that means that 3/4 of our workforce have got no input into the terms and conditions on which they work, because, of course, individual workers have got no negotiating power. When you go for a job, you either accept the terms that are offered or you go and look for another job. So this workers' voice can only realistically be expressed through collective bargaining. And in order to establish collective bargaining on an extensive basis, it's necessary to have some form of legislation. And we had legislation in the past supported by government policy of all political persuasions through the first 3/4 of the 20th century. And just as a footnote, it's worth remembering that the EU, in a directive a year ago on minimum adequate wages directed all countries in the EU to come up with an action plan to achieve 80% coverage of collective bargaining if they hadn't already done so. Many countries in the EU have much higher levels even than 80%.
Keith, what proposals are made by in the bill here, and is it enough to bring us up to this European 80% standard?
Well, I think that's a good question. I mean, if you look at the levels of coverage of collective bargaining in this country, compare us with where the OECD countries are, that's the other industrialised countries, compare us to where other EU countries are, we are at the bottom of the pile. Now, we're in the bottom half in terms of the OECD, 40 or so countries. If we were still in the EU, I think we'd probably have the second lowest level of coverage of any country in the EU. I think only Lithuania has fewer workers covered as a percentage of the workforce. So for me, the biggest crisis in our labour law at the moment is the declining levels of trade union membership, which are much lower today than it was, less than half it was when I started work in 1978. Declining levels of collective bargaining coverage, which, as John said, has fallen from something like 82, 86% to something like 25 to 30% today. So that is an inexorable decline, which has to be redressed, and we've got to turn the corner on this. Now, the question then is, what does the bill do? Well, you know, Labour had proposed in the New Deal that we would roll out a programme of sectoral bargaining across the economy, and that would have the effect of raising levels of coverage. The effect of that in turn would be to raise wages. The effect of that would be to reduce inequality. If we look at the bill, we see all that's been stripped out. And so far as the bill is concerned, it is very light to non-existent on collective bargaining. There are two initiatives. One is to have some kind of sector-wide arrangement for school support staff. Another is to have a sector-wide initiative for social care workers. They're both very important, but they're not enough. And it's even doubtful in any event whether they would constitute what we would recognise as collective bargaining. If you take the case of the school support staff, you've got basically it's a system which is controlled by the minister, whoever the minister will be. So the minister will control the composition of the so-called negotiating body. The minister will control the budget about which they can negotiate. The minister will control the remit in terms of the subject matter of negotiations. The minister can decide whether or not to accept the recommendations. The minister can send back any recommendations to the party, but can ultimately can override any decision which the negotiating parties come up with. So it's not really collective bargaining in the sense it's a negotiation with a license from the minister to come up with an agreement which is satisfactory to the minister for their purposes. So the main failing, I think, here is the failure to accept the importance of collective bargaining as an instrument for dealing with problems in the workplace and for redressing the balance of power in the workplace, for raising wages and equalising incomes and opportunities. And simply, I mean, basically, we're left then with just a silence, there's just a space where that should be dealt with. And this is an opportunity that will probably never come again.
I think it's worth pointing out that amongst the benefits that Keith and I have mentioned for extensive collective bargaining, there are particular benefits for employers as well, because by sector-wide collective bargaining, you set the minimum terms and conditions on which labour is hired. Therefore, you stabilise labour costs across an entire sector, which means that bad employers can't undercut good employers. The other useful thing from an employer's point of view is that, as we've both said, extensive collective bargaining necessarily or almost inevitably raises wages. And the consequence of that is that workers spend that money. They're not like bankers that salt it in the Cayman Islands. They actually spend the money that they receive by way of wages. And that's good for the economy. It increases demand in the economy. It increases the level of tax take for the government. It reduces in-work benefits paid out by the government. So it's an all-round win situation to have extensive collective bargaining of that kind. And I just don't understand what the rationale was for the current government in dropping sectoral collective bargaining across the entire economy as originally planned in a New Deal for Working People, which was the policy document adopted by the Labour Party conference in 2021, reiterated again in 2022, and endorsed by the leadership of the Labour Party. I just cannot see how you can rationalise just extending it, collective bargaining, with all the conditions that Keith has mentioned, to simply two sectors, social care and school support staff. Surely anybody looking at our economy would think agricultural workers need it, hospitality workers need it, delivery riders and drivers need it. And unfortunately, the bill as drafted doesn't establish a mechanism for collective bargaining which could be applied to other sectors. It restricts it simply to social care and school support staff. So there's no mechanism in the bill which would permit the minister to say, I'm convinced by the argument that agricultural workers should once again have an agricultural wages board as they did from 1922 right through to 2013. I'm going to set it up again. Can't do it. The bill won't permit. I think it's very disappointing.
The Labour Party said in various discussion papers or policy documents that were produced before the election that these two sectors, social care and school support staff, these were to be templates for the kind of rolling out of sectoral-wide bargaining more widely. But there's nothing in the bill which would allow for this type of arrangement to be extended to any other sector. So that means it's going to have to be fresh legislation. Well, you've got to just ask yourself, how likely is it that there's going to be another employment rights bill dealing with the question of sector-wide collective bargaining that will be introduced this side of the next general election? My estimation is that it'd be highly unlikely that that would happen. I mean, it seems to me that, I mean, having committed themselves to this, and I think in 2021, in the policy documents at the time, approved by a Labour Party conference, and then to have dropped it after the EU went ahead with the directive in 2022. I mean, the point is that if we had still been in the European Union, it would not have been possible for Labour to have dropped this commitment that was in the 2021 policy document. We would have been required to put in place an action plan that would get us to an 80% level of coverage, which is what the EU is requiring, of collective bargaining within a period of 5 years. It would be impossible for us to do that. But we would have to be set on a programme which would get us to that at some time in the future. But in a sense, it's just an extraordinary Brexit dividend, which even more extraordinarily, the Starmer government has taken full advantage of. And I'm just amazed that there has been no response from the organised trade union movement to raise the requirements of the directive and to draw attention to what we've lost and to demand that the Labour government at least match what is going on in Brussels at the moment.
Quite right. It's not pie in the sky stuff, is it? Because we've had a tripartite negotiating system pre-Thatcher. Thatcher obviously infamously dismantled it. But there are other similar systems in other countries, aren't there? I'm just wondering if there are any sort of international comparisons where we could look at where it's working quite well at present.
Well, I mean, the OECD, I mean, if you look at their figures, they've got collective bargaining coverage at about 98, 99 or 100%. So, and that's done by sector-wide agreements. I mean, it's not rocket science in a sense. What you do is you have negotiations between trade unions and employers' organisations in each particular industry or each sector of the economy. They reach an agreement which regulates terms and conditions for workers in the sector, whether they're unionised or not, whether the employer is a member of the Employers' Federation or not. That applies to every worker in the sector. So everybody is governed by the terms of these agreements. And that would be fairly standard practice. throughout most of mainland Europe. But there are other models, which we might refer to as the Anglo-Saxon model, which we bought into, the American style. And compared to the European model, where collective bargaining coverage on a sector-wide basis is up in the 70s, 80s, 90s percent, to my knowledge, there is no country in the world which has adopted the American style model, which has a collective bargaining density in excess of 40%. So the model you adopt to promote collective bargaining determines the level of coverage within the economy as a whole, the level of coverage of the people who will be protected by the agreement. And we've, in a sense, we've bet the house on this statutory recognition model, which isn't working. Collective bargaining coverage continues to fall despite this legislation, which has been operational now since 2000, 25 years almost. Despite that, collective bargaining coverage continues to fall. Despite that, despite the fact that the government has turned its back on the European model, on sector bargaining, despite the fact that the recognition model, the enterprise-based model, is failing, still the bill does nothing about that. There are two inconsequential amendments in the bill to address some of the major weaknesses of the recognition procedure, which basically will not deliver a wider coverage of collective bargaining. It's a system that has been tried and failed in many countries throughout the world. And there's no reason to believe that the two changes, the two tweaks that are made in the bill will make any difference to the levels of coverage in this country.
I'm glad you mentioned recognition there. And that was going to be one of me.
Just before we come sorry, on to go recognition, on, John. Can I just add a couple of points? You asked whether there are other comparable countries, and Keith has spoken generally about the situation in European countries. But if you look at the most successful economies in Europe, they are all countries which have got a higher level of collective bargaining coverage. When I say successful economies, I don't mean just that they're wealthy economies with a high GDP. They're economies where inequality is much less than it is in Britain. They haven't got the level of in-work poverty that we've got in Britain. And if you look at the comparison between the UK and leading OECD countries, the decline that Keith has talked about follows exactly the decline in collective bargaining coverage in the United Kingdom. That's why we're bottom of the pile, as Keith says, on so many metrics, not least in terms of productivity, as well, of course, as inequality. But I just wanted to take up another point that Keith made, which was that we probably won't get another chance to tackle this problem in this parliament, and probably not for another generation or so. This is a pivotal moment for us. Quite rightly, the government says this is the biggest upgrade in workers' rights for a generation. That's looking backwards a generation. This is the only chance we're going to have for a generation ahead. And in reality, this is the first realistic chance we've had to revise the industrial relations structure of this country since Mrs. Thatcher came to power in 1979. And what is absolutely essential is, for all the individual rights that the government are going to grant workers is important, and they are important rights, carers' leave and all the rest of it. For all that's important, the most important thing of all is to return some power to working people to control and influence the terms and conditions on which they work. And that means empowering the trade unions to represent and to defend them. And therefore, I'm with Keith on this. That it's really for the trade union movement now to exert pressure to get collective bargaining extended. Otherwise, the decline that Keith has mentioned, decline in membership of unions from 13.5 million in 1978-79 down to just over 6 million today, will continue, and we'll end up like the American unions, where you've got a coverage of less than 10% in the private sector, perhaps double that in the public sector. And what that will mean for working people in this country is that they will simply have no input into the terms and conditions on which they work and the wages for which they go to work. This is a critical moment, and what we're discussing, the extension of collective bargaining, is the critical issue within this bill.
So we mentioned recognition then, perhaps that's one of them, but one of my questions was going to be that what is necessary to achieve collective bargaining coverage at least as extensive as that required in the EU? So recognition, getting the recognition procedure right, one of them. What other thing?
I mean, you'll never do it by the recognition procedure. I mean, they're just... The only way you can get to, and the EU recognises this, the only way you can get to 80% or anything like it would be by having sector-wide agreements, which, you know, have blanket coverage across a particular industry. The recognition procedure can't do it. I mean, it's just impossible for the recognition procedure to carry this burden. I mean, trade unions have got to take on each employer individually. They've got to build up membership, support, strength when individual companies go through a statutory procedure, be frustrated by all the loopholes and technicalities in the legislation, as happened, for example, at Amazon, face hostile anti-union activity from the employer to defeat a well-supported union campaign. You just can't do it. It's just not possible for the recognition procedure to carry that burden. The fact that you've got sector-wide bargaining doesn't preclude the existence of enterprise-based bargaining as well. So you could have, for example, in the railways, you could have a single agreement which would cover all the railway companies, but you could still have individual bargaining with individual companies, which would build on the national sector-wide agreement. So where there's productivity improvements in one company, well, that can be rewarded with higher wages. You can negotiate different working time arrangements, different holiday pay, a different sick pay arrangements. All that can be done. So you could have multiple layers of regulation. And so you start off with the sector-wide agreement. On top of that, you can have enterprise-based or company-based bargaining, much easier to accomplish if you've got a sector-wide framework sitting underneath on which you can build. But in direct answer to your question, if you want to improve or get to these high levels, get back to where we were, we did have 80% coverage from 1934 right through to 1980. It was public policy in this country to support sector-wide agreements. Trade unions led the campaign and the demands and the operation of these agreements. Trade unions today have forgotten about that. They've forgotten about their role as regulators on behalf of workers in determining terms and conditions of employment. What we have instead is this enterprise-based system where unions are simply representing defined groups of workers in their direct relationships with their employers. And well, that's fine, but it can't be the fulfillment of trade union ambition or the zenith of trade union activity. We've got to get back to a position where trade unions themselves understand that they have a much more important role to play than the one which they're currently performing.
It's worth remembering that the essential feature of recognition machinery, both here and in the United States, is that the union or unions can only achieve recognition with a particular employer, a single employer. There's no mechanism for multi-employer agreements to be reached under the recognition machinery. It perhaps also worth just recalling what the pattern of collective bargaining was prior to the governments from 1979 onwards. You had statutory compulsory collective bargaining through the wages councils, which at their peak covered 3.5 million workers. You had voluntary sector-wide agreements covering much of British industry, supported by government. And of course, you in the public sector, government itself insisted on sector-wide collective bargaining for all public servants in the civil service, for teachers, in local authorities and councils and everywhere. There was a joint national council to set minimum terms and conditions. That's really what we ought to go back to. The legislation establishing collective bargaining under the wages councils was only one part of the legal machinery to support sectoral collective bargaining. There were many other mechanisms as well. For example, public procurement legislation, that's to say the conditions on which public contracts would be let to private contractors, required adhesion to local agreements and recognition of unions and so on. There were legal mechanisms to extend existing collective agreements to employers in the district or trade which hadn't themselves agreed them in order to prevent undercutting. That's the sort of landscape that we need to go back to, and this bill just doesn't touch it.
Mm. So if the bill and the machinery of government does not facilitate or achieve collective bargaining at sector level across the economy, what do you see as the consequences for workers in the next 10 to 20 years maybe?
Speaking for myself, I think it's a very bleak prospect. I think terms and conditions will stagnate. We've already had 14 years of no growth in real wages. I think that's likely to continue. In fact, the real value of wages may fall. Certainly, the real value of wages in the United Kingdom as compared to Western Europe have fallen over the last 40 years. And I think that may continue. And of course, as collective bargaining declines and union membership declines as well, unions have got less and less resources to apply in defending workers and seeking further collective bargaining. Unions are going to become, I'm afraid, irrelevant to a lot of workers. They're already irrelevant to a lot of workers because so many are not covered by existing collective agreements. That situation is going to get worse unless we take the opportunity now to extend collective bargaining coverage.
Yeah, there's nothing in the bill about pay. Not nothing, but very little. We've got the two public sector bodies, the care and school support staff. But the only commitment at the moment relates to the minimum wage, which, you know, is a minimum wage. So in the sense that that's not going to make a massive effect in reducing the surging inequality levels in this country. And really it comes down to the responsibility of government. So when in the past we had these high levels of collective bargaining coverage at sector level, that was associated with the presence of a Ministry of Labour in government. So you had a cabinet minister with their own departments. The Ministry of Labour became Department for Employment. Very famous Minister of Labour was Ernie Bevin, who was General Secretary of the Transport and General Workers Union at the time he took office. And part of the job of the Ministry of Labour and its officials was to protect workers in government. And part of the process of protection was to ensure that there was this expansive coverage of self-government through sectoral-wide collective bargaining, which would create its own machinery for resolving disputes and all the rest of it. So until we get back to a position where government accepts that it has a responsibility and trade unions accept that the government has a responsibility to facilitate and to promote their activities on an economic-wide basis in a way which the EU now anticipates, then as John says, we will continue to see an erosion of working standards because at the moment, the baseline is set by the minimum wage. And that's it for most workers. The minimum wage is the ceiling. And there's nothing above it, apart from whatever market power they may have to determine individually through their contract of employment a higher wage than that which the minimum wage provides. And in terms of the role of the government, thinking about the Amazon case where, you know, Amazon workers trying to get recognition. But I read today another GMB post that in the last year, Amazon has been awarded government contracts worth £1 billion. So, you know, the government has to accept some responsibility for ensuring that the collective bargaining coverage is expanded. And this, I would say, is not consistent with that responsibility of government. So in a sense, government's got to be speaking with a consistent voice when it comes to supporting workers, not undermining them in this way.
Okay, I think we're going to leave this conversation here for now. As I said previously, this is a two-part episode, so please do look out for the following episode on collective rights. Thanks to our speakers, Professor Keith Ewing and Lord Hendy KC, for sharing their knowledge and experience with us and for taking time out of their extraordinarily busy schedules to be part of this. If you'd like to support the work of IER, you can donate to us, subscribe to our labour law publications, or attend our educational events. If you'd simply like to learn more, you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at ier.org.uk. Thanks again to Thompson Solicitors for their kind support for the podcast, and thanks to you, the listeners, for being part of our new podcast and being part of the debate.
This podcast is sponsored by Thompson Solicitors, and it's produced for the Institute of Employment Rights by Creative Kin. To find out more, visit creativekin.co.uk/IER.